You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Max.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
Doing well. How are you?
Good. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show on Blogging Heads TV, and you're Max Blumenthal. And you're the author of, among other books, Goliath, a book about Israel, and a book called Republican Gomorrah, which sounds like a not altogether flattering look at the Republican Party. I don't know. Is that fair to say?
I think it foreshadowed the Republican Party of today pretty well. And
prescient. And you can, I will call it prescient, and you can use that as a blurb should it be reissued.
Yeah, it should be reissued, but it probably won't. And I hear you can get it used for 50 cents. So.
Okay. Well, I'm calling it prescient. So the reason I want to talk to you is because I've decided to have a series of conversations that help me get the lay of the ideological land these days, including the lay of the kind of media landscape ideology-wise, because there's been some shifting, you know, partly because of Trump. Right. There's some kind of strange bedfellows and stuff. And so I want to talk to people and ask them where they see themselves on the landscape and where they see others. And relevantly, you have a new podcast that you just started called Moderate Rebels, co-hosted with Ben Norton. And so before I ask you how you see yourself ideologically, why don't you tell me where the name Moderate, what the name Moderate Rebels is supposed to signify?
I mean, it was kind of, you know, a sort of tongue-in-cheek name referencing the label deployed by the American National Security State and the kind of Beltway commentariat that supported intervention in Syria to market the Salafi jihadi insurgents as moderates so that the CIA could embark on this billion-dollar operation to arm them and basically drive a country into ruin and spawn a massive refugee crisis that's put enormous pressure on Europe. And, you know, so I think the term Moderate Rebels and just the farce that it speaks to really helps outline the sensibility of our podcast and the kind of, you know, targets we're going after.
Okay, so it's safe to paint you as a skeptic of the bipartisan foreign policy consensus.
To put it lightly.
Now, here's an interesting question, I think. Does that by itself put you on the left? Or, I mean, you may be on the left for other reasons, but does this position put you on the left?
Well, it puts me on the left, and it makes it, you know, increasingly impossible for me to, you know, build kind of partnerships or coalitions with self-identified liberals. And this is, I think not a new development, but it's a trend that's consolidated itself in the Trump era.
The reason I ask if it puts you on the left is because during the presidential campaign, Trump had some supporters from the kind of Pat Buchanan right, who I think would share your view on Syria. And they thought that he shared it, right? I mean, they thought he was going to be non-interventionist and in a kind of a realist way, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that conversation requires, you know, an analysis of how the Trump administration was basically handed over to the bipartisan foreign policy consensus. I think that's one of the stories of the year that hasn't really been told by any mainstream publication, at least. But yeah, there were definitely the libertarians, the Buchananites, the American conservative crowd. And, you know, I find a lot of reasonable writing in American conservative these days that wrongly saw Trump as and his so-called America First agenda as a vehicle for kind of rolling back American empire and bringing America home. For me, you know, someone from the left, it's about, you know, a massive reinvestment in, you know, public infrastructure and the people of this country, especially, you know, the working class and people who have been driven into poverty. And the only way that that's going to be able to happen is if the military budget is massively, massively reduced. And, you know, we just saw with the last NDAA, almost a near record budget busting NDAA of $700 million, Mm-hmm. Bill Harding has demonstrated that over half of that money is going to go to private contractors. So, you know, Trump's America First agenda has basically been reduced to some kind of opposition to TPP. And it was, you know, if you watch the panels at Davos last week, it was really the only thing about his agenda that seemed to rankle the global elite.
Okay. Now, who are some other known people that you would put roughly in your camp on these issues, and maybe in a more broadly ideological way? But I mean, I have some suggestions who would seem to come to mind, but why don't you go first?
I really, you know, it's going to make this conversation not very good viewing if I'm going to have to call up names.
Let me ask you,
go on.
Well, no, go ahead.
I don't know. The most obvious one would be Glenn Greenwald, although,
right,
you know, he's more outspoken about some issues than I about others, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that would be, you know, the most recognizable name for people watching this.
And, yeah, and did you see this thing that was written by what's-his-name for Vanity Fair, James Walcott, where he I guess he kind of coined the term alt-left?
Yeah, I did.
Now, it had some problems, I thought. Like, for example, he included Mickey Kouse as the alt-left. Did he mention you? He mentioned Glenn Greenwald, Michael Tracy.
Yeah, he mentioned, you know, Mark Ames and a bunch of people I respect, people who've basically been consistently principled through this era when most self-identified liberals have kind of stepped away from a lot of the beliefs that I thought characterized traditional Schlesingerian liberalism, and you know, brought back the kind of Americans for Democratic Action, Cold War liberalism, and you know, really what Wolcott was doing was trying to establish a false equivalency between the white supremacist, white nationalist alt-right and the alt-left that supported Bernie Sanders, that believes in socialism, that's anti-imperialist. And so it was an absolute slur across the board. Wolcott was really expressing the anxiety of liberals that they have to actually beat back a challenge from the left, and that the country rejected Hillary Clinton and their, not just their agenda to the extent that they have a coherent agenda, but their entire sensibility, their sense of destiny, and that their worldview is collapsing. So, you know, the alt-left, I mean, we actually, Ben Norton and I did kind of an examination of when this term emerged. It actually emerged from the circles that we call the Syria regime change trolls. And it's a group of younger people, writers, journalists, who are extremely active on Twitter, who wanted to attack opponents, left-wing opponents of regime change in Syria, of U.S. intervention. And so they coined the term alt-left, and it was really, it emerged on Twitter in early 2016, and then it worked its way further into the mainstream with figures like Neera Tanden, who is the president of the Democrat think tank Center for American Progress, kind of using it as an insult against Bernie Sanders supporters. And, you know, Trump finally brought it to the mainstream media. I believe it was his press conference on Charlottesville, one of the most shameful episodes of the Trump era, when he attempted to conflate the alt-right marchers in Charlottesville with what he called the alt-left.
I missed that. Did he use the term alt-left? And did he? What
he used a term that emerged from liberal interventionist and, you know, beltway liberal establishment circles to smear the people who had rallied in Charlottesville against the fact that white supremacists and gun-toting Nazis were marching through their town. And, you know, James Wolcott is someone who should be really ashamed of that.
So Trump was using it to disparage the critics of the Charlottesville march.
Yeah, and to draw a false equivalency between both sides, who he said both had good people and both had bad people.
Now, it seemed to me that kind of the keystone of Walcott's analysis, such as it was, and again, the fact that he brought Mickey Kouse into it kind of blows the whole thing apart. I mean, calling it anything left, if you're going to include Mickey in it. But the keystone of the analysis, aside from that, that might arguably apply to everybody else, was and maybe to Mickey, was a skepticism about the Russia investigation, or a form of skepticism that was not found among liberals broadly, right?
Yeah.
So that you and Glenn and Michael Tracy kind of share some of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's really, you know, you're touching the third rail when you express skepticism about Russian collusion. You know, when you talk about the fact that there should be detente between the U.S. and Russia, when you challenge the portrayal of Vladimir Putin as the world's number one villain, you know, without, you know, expressing support for him, that's really the third rail right now in American politics. And, you know, that it really puts you on the margins. And, you know, the Russiagate, the whole Russiagate narrative for me has really exposed these kind of techno-solutionist liberals who believe in facts and objectivity in opposition to fake news, who consider themselves part of the reality-based community and spend their Saturday nights laughing at the you know, middle American rabble who support Trump and laughing at Trump on SNL. It's really exposed them as just as suggestible and easily duped as, you know, the Alex Jones conspiracists and the Tea Party crowd that they hold in so much contempt, because they're really operating without any clear concrete evidence of Russian collusion. And beyond that, they have adopted a Cold War narrative and are right now fuming about the fact that Trump's State Department has refused to impose new sanctions. I never thought that sanctions were such a great idea, especially after already imposing them based on the thinnest read of evidence about, you know, the hacking of the DNC servers. I mean, that's a separate conversation, but what it says about liberals to me is really telling. There aren't really any clear foreign policy principles there. There's no analysis of Russia and its role in the world, and particularly in its region. There's no demand for real evidence. All there is are partisan imperatives and a kind of sensibility, an anti-Trump sensibility.
Well, tell me this. Some critics of the so-called alt-left, I mean, on this issue, would see the...
You mean can we call it the left or the traditional left?
Yeah, if that's what it is, I mean, I'm fine with that.
Because there is no alt-left.
Right, okay. Critics of leftist skeptics of the Russia investigation. Some of them would attribute it, the skepticism, to some kind of long-standing leftist sympathy for Russia that goes back to when Russia was communist or something. Now, I assume that's not the connection between the skepticism and leftism that you see, right? I mean, you see the skepticism as growing out of your leftist position, but in a different way, presumably.
I think there, you know, are different reasons people are skeptical, but I mean, I can argue the evidence. You know, having said that, in many ways, I'm sympathetic to Russia's foreign policy in Syria, in Crimea, in Ukraine. They had NATO knocking on their doorstep after a coup, which has clearly brought neo-Nazi elements out into the open. In Syria, Russian intervention, along with Iran and Hezbollah, has saved a stable state from collapse, basically saved Lebanon, saved a complete collapse of the Middle East. And Russia's intervention was triggered by a U.S.-led proxy war. So, I mean, you know, we also have to look at Russia's position in the world. I'm not sympathetic to, you know, the party of Vladimir Putin, United Russia, which, you know, represents, you know, many conservative impulses that have become popular in Russia because of the collapse of the Soviet Union. And liberals feel that way too. They don't like the anti-LGBT stuff. You know, a lot of liberals are, you know, they don't like Vladimir Putin's image of this, you know, burly, virile guy who goes, you know, goes out in the woods with his shirt off. But this is, you know, this is what you've gotten because of the policies of Bill Clinton, because of the desire from the United States to collapse the Soviet Union. And there is a sympathy on the left for frontline socialist states, like from Venezuela, Venezuela and Cuba, for example, that resist U.S. empire.
Well, yeah, but Russia is not really socialist anymore.
Russia is not socialist, but it's still part of a multipolar world that millions and millions, billions of people want to see. And so really what it comes down to is not any ideology. Like, there's no ideological rift between Russia and the United States. They're both running along neoliberal lines. And that's, you know, thanks to the United States, we made Russia like us. And if you want to call Russia a kleptocracy, we'll look back at what we did to it in the 1990s when Larry Summers was writing their economic shock therapy policies and triggering 3 to 5 million excess deaths. This is what we did to them. And so it led to the rise of Vladimir Putin. And we have to put it all in context. But at the same time, Russia has a good cause to be wary of NATO expanding and putting advanced arms systems on its borders. And if you believe in a multipolar world where the United States doesn't control everything, then you are naturally going to be not just, it goes well beyond the Russiagate investigation to the implications of a hostile policy to Russia, because you believe in detente, you believe in diplomacy, you believe that, that China has a right to be concerned about the American Navy putting pressure on its own shipping lines in the South China Sea. You respect other countries' sovereignty. And so this is in many ways where the left is coming from. And beyond that, we also have to look at what U.S. empire has done to the world in recent years, what the bipartisan foreign policy consensus has done to the world in recent years, and how the anti-war left has been neutered since the Bush era, particularly under Obama. I mean, one of the key interventions was Libya, and I wasn't vocal about it. I really regret that. And I fell for the Syrian operation early on, like so many other people. And now we see the effects of it. There are open-air slave markets in Libya. The country's divided between warlords, a refugee crisis, which Gaddafi had warned European leaders about, has triggered the rise of the far right in Europe. And the center left has no response to it at all. And it's that same center left that supported all these interventions. And they're walking blindly into this conflict with Russia to fulfill partisan imperatives. So, you know, it's really the role of people on the left to look at the world as it is, to put ourselves in the shoes of people who are not Americans, who have their own interests, and then to warn people in this country of what could come next if we go down this road of endless conflict with a nuclear power that has the second-ranked military in the world.
Well, the reason I keep getting back to, you know, the question of whether that part of it should be called left is a lot of what you're saying would characterize a right-wing realism in foreign policy. Understand the perspective of the other people. You understand that they consider their sovereignty sacred, just as we do. Respect stability as an important thing. Notwithstanding qualms you may have about human rights or whatever within a country's borders, just recognize that violently destabilizing a country carries very human risks of its own, and so on. So a lot of that is characteristic of the right. Not much anymore, but I mean, there was and is to some extent a strand of realism on the right, as we alluded to. When I said in what ways is your skepticism the investigation rooted in a leftist kind of tradition, I thought one thing you might say is, which is sometimes said, and Glenn Greenwald I think says this, is like, wait a second, we on the left, supposedly, including liberals generally, have had a certain skepticism of the FBI, of evidence that is leaked from the CIA, the FBI, whatever, the security apparatus, and we shouldn't take these things at face value. And I assume you'd say that too. But in any event, I want to distinguish between kind of two dimensions of this issue. There is, on the one hand, there is skepticism about whether the investigation will really turn up some sort of elaborate conspiracy. And in theory, you could turn out to be right or wrong about that. But then there was also a view about how menacing Russia inherently is and the extent to which we ourselves have exacerbated relations with Russia. So in other words, there's that view of kind of the FBI and everything, and then there's the foreign policy issue. And I guess my point is, if you turned out to be wrong about the investigation, and there really was an incredibly rich conspiracy going on and a quid pro quo, and Trump said, look, if you'll give us these emails, we'll change our Ukraine policy and blah, 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 you would still hold the view you hold about how we should be handling Russia in international relations, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's why I front-loaded the foreign policy aspect of the discussion in our conversation, because even if, and I highly doubt that there will be any concrete evidence of an elaborate conspiracy by Trump and the Russian FSB and GRU and Putin to subvert the American electorate in favor of Trump, but if there is, we can still say that for the sake of humanity, for the sake of humanity, there still has to be detente and diplomacy between two nuclear powers who are right now heavily involved in the Middle East and in Eastern Europe. And, you know, a conflict could be triggered at any moment or escalate at any moment in Donbass. There are negotiations over Syria right now in Sochi. This is what we have to be concerned about. This is about humanity. Then beyond that, let's talk about the DNC leaks. You know, what emerged from them? The DNC leaks didn't seem to swing the election in any way to me. Maybe they confirmed the impression by supporters of Bernie Sanders that the DNC was rigging the primary against them. But this is something that Bernie Sanders supporters already suspected. Then Bernie went out and endorsed Hillary Clinton. Most of his supporters voted for her in the key areas, and she went and ran one of the worst campaigns in history. Mm-hmm. So I don't even think that we can even say that alleged Russian meddling swung the election. The Podesta emails are frequently conflated with the DNC emails leaks. But John Podesta basically answered, he fell for a phishing scheme. Where he gave away his password after asking a Hillary Clinton security administrator, should I answer this email? It seems fishy. And the administrator
said, yes, you should. And then later said, that was a typo. I meant, no, you shouldn't.
No, you should not. And then so he put in his password, which was password one. I thought those emails sort of helped reinforce.
Well, it's better than password. You have to admit, password one is a more secure password than just password. So it couldn't work.
True. I mean, you know, I think he had to add the number because Gmail and Yahoo and whatever what did he have? Hotmail, one of those kind of,
I don't know.
Accounts for older people, but they,
Hey, careful. We're not all
anyway, my point is, no one's really illustrated how Russian meddling swung the election. And now we're talking about these Facebook ads, which were, emerged from a troll factory in St. Petersburg called the Internet Research Agency. Facebook's own data showed that 56% of them were published after the election. 25% of them were seen by no one, and that most of them did not take a position on a candidate, pro Clinton or pro Trump. They tended to relate to a wide array of issues, including puppies. There were puppy memes, so I call this Puppygate. But I saw a poll on CNN that showed 82% of liberals, you know, the techno-solutionist people, the reality-based community, believe that the Facebook ads from a private Russian troll factory actually swung the election. So again, it's not about evidence. It's about what people have been, how malleable Democrats have become in the hands of this Russiagate narrative.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we don't have a ton of time because, as you know, we had some technical difficulties going in, but I do want to get into this ideology issue a little more, and then quickly pivot to the kind of media landscape question. And so the final question about ideology per se is, I guess, is this: is your? I'm somebody who I don't, in terms of my domestic policy preferences, I don't consider myself super far to the left and certainly not to the right. I'm left of center. And yet I do have a certain sympathy for some of the foreign policy perspective you've described. And I guess I don't see any necessary correlation between between domestic policy preferences and foreign policy view. And so I guess my question for you is, are you finding that everyone who is kind of pretty far left on domestic policy, like socialist left, is on the same page on kind of the Russia thing and the foreign policy thing?
Well, I mean, the Russia thing is part of a wider analysis for people on the actual left. I mean, you'd be talking about people who are actual Marxist-Leninists, like the Party for Socialism and Liberation, who are, you know, kind of referred to in a pejorative term as tankies, who tend to get all of the major issues right, regardless of what their ideology or agenda is. You know, those people have an analysis that was, you know, has been spelled out, which is anti-imperial and anti-capitalist, and they go hand in hand. And so they would see the importance of preventing the dissolution of frontline resistance states that even operate, you know, according to a kind of a bourgeois economic guideline like Syria or Russia against the base of empire, which is the U.S. So, you know, people who have a socialist or communist vision for the U.S. also have an anti-imperial analysis for the world. And, you know, they can find common ground with, you know, the people you mentioned on the right, the realist and kind of isolationist foreign policy crowd. But those people obviously are, you know, coming at it from an entirely different angle. The idea of horseshoe theory, I think, is a little bit overblown. And it's, again, it's used to conflate the left and the alt-right by centrists who really don't have a clear analysis and have just proven to be extremely unprincipled in the Trump era. So, I mean, I just tend to find myself avoiding ideology, but embracing certain principles because of, you know, my own experience in journalism and my own experience with history since 9/11. And, you know, I'll be spelling that out in a book that I've written about 9/11 and how it's affected our politics. But, you know, the book is not an ideological tract. It's more historical.
Mm-hmm. So let's do pivot to media. And I guess part of the context for this is the foreign policy view you've described doesn't seem to me to be it's not being advanced explicitly or implicitly by many major media properties right now.
No.
And I mean, the you get a little of it in The Intercept, but I mean, that's almost it. And on your podcast, Moderate Rebels, your most recent one is an interesting thing about Vice News. And, you know, I haven't watched that much Vice, but I know a few years ago I'd seen just a little of it. I didn't have a clear sense of the ideology. I asked somebody, do they have an ideology? He said, I don't think so. But you guys, you had a guest on who's looked into this a lot. And one thing you said is that Vice, well, first of all, it actually has some kind of ideological roots that are maybe right, maybe even alt-right. But that aside, that a few years ago, it got a huge infusion of kind of establishment money, including Fox money, which I gather put one of Murdoch's sons on its board. And it also developed a kind of symbiosis with the Obama administration. And as a result, according to this analysis, your guest analysis, became kind of a tool of, well, the bipartisan, it's funny, the bipartisan foreign policy consensus that in some, you know, in its more radical moments, the Obama administration referred to as the blob, right? But when it wasn't being part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I got to give them credit. You can tell there was a certain resistance to parts of the blob in the Obama administration. But anyway, by this analysis, it's all one blob. It's Obama and And Trump has, whatever he said during the campaign, has moved toward it. And it includes both liberal interventionists and neocons. And you're saying that vice has become a total tool of it.
Well, it's not just a tool. It's the most useful tool. Vice, with its hipster aesthetic, is able to normalize American empire behind this transgressive brand, which, as you kind of alluded to, the brand was crafted by Gavin McGinnis, who's now one of the major faces and voices of the white supremacist alt-right. You know, there was a massive cash infusion from, you know, Disney and ABC and all sorts of corporate media conglomerates into Vice and beginning in the Obama era because of the success of that brand. And Obama's deputy chief of staff, Alyssa Mastromonaco, came over as the chief operating officer of Vice, brought Joe Biden into the office in Brooklyn 2 days later. And, you know, meanwhile, you have all this young talent coming through there who are pushing regime change in Vice documentaries like A World in Disarray, which is based on the book by Richard Haass, who's the head of Council on Foreign Relations now, but he's someone who said that, you know, we need to support, in his own words, American empire after 9/11, the advancement of American empire. So it's never been more naked, but Vice's brand has brought it a lot of support and made it this kind of insidious instrument of what I call American regime media. You know, it's just dangerous being in this country right now from a political or intellectual point of view, because Americans, especially Americans in my generation and younger, have been cultivated to believe that they live in a real democracy, that they have freedom of choice, that they're individuals, unlike people, unlike my Russian friends who know when they're being propagandized, my Egyptian friends, my friends who've grown up in countries that were not open and democratic. And so they really think that they're being given the truth, the objective truth, by outlets like Vice. When, you know, these outlets are working hand in glove. Vice is working hand in glove with the Broadcasting Board of Governors, which is basically the U.S. arm of foreign propaganda, which oversees Voice of America and Radio Free Europe, to provide content domestically that advances this bipartisan foreign policy vision that's brought so much destruction to the world and to this country. So, you know, I really feel more, in a way, I feel more marginalized than ever in American media and progressive media. I'm no longer, you know, getting invited onto Democracy Now, which has cast its lot with the kind of MIC resistance. So many progressive outlets have gone full Russiagate. There are internal battles in outlets like The Nation, which have attempted to resist the Russiagate narrative, where the liberal factions are actually trying to get certain people fired. And what I've been able to do, because I've had my own brand and kind of my own ability to travel the country because of my work on Israel-Palestine, is to raise money from individual donors and have my own kind of project, which I, you know, have worked with Ben Norton, the co-host of Moderate Rebels, on, called the Gray Zone Project. And, you know, there are a few brave people in media who have helped us sponsor it. Jan Frel at Alternet, and we're going to be moving to The Real News, which is an independent left-wing progressive news outlet in Baltimore. And Paul Jay is also someone who's been really brave. But, you know, there's a lot of self-censorship right now and a lot of peer pressure in progressive media. And it's really, put me on the margins. And then we're also witnessing an attack on alternative media through Russiagate, specifically the attack on RT America, which has been forced to register as a foreign agent. I consider that an essential part of alternative media landscape in the U.S. And one of the things that RT brings to the table is it's not subject to pressure campaigns on Israel, for example. The Israel lobby can't come in and say, well, we're going to get your advertisement pulled. We're going to, you know, mobilize people.
Now, but I assume RT is to some extent a tool of the Russian government.
You know, less than people think from my experience with it, but we can say, sure, it could be an arm of Russian soft power, and it can also provide fill a void in the American media landscape. But you know, if you look at RT, Al Jazeera, any of the Telesur, I mean, if you actually get into the network and see how it works, there are centers of power that are totally disconnected from their government sponsors. And basically, you have a lot of young correspondents with more independence than they'd have at somewhere like MSNBC. You know, I used to work with Chris Hayes at The Nation, and I've seen how, you know, I don't recognize anything particularly, left wing about his show. And I know he's probably individually someone who would agree with me on a lot of things, but when you go into Comcast or you go into Time Warner at CNN, or you go into the Bezos Post, the Washington Post, you're under management control. And it just doesn't work that way when you're at RT America, Telesur, or even Al Jazeera English. So, you know, I think these networks are going to find themselves under increasing attack because the element that we've been talking about this whole time, this bipartisan establishment, but particularly the center left, is defending its narrative against all of these challenges. And the only way at the end of the day that it can preserve its control over the narrative is by appealing to state authority. And so that's what's happening. And I think, you know, it's not going to stop with RT. I think anyone on the left, anyone who's concerned about all, you know, dissident media should be worried.
You know, I think there's another dynamic at work that may be related and overlap with what you're talking about, which is that very worked up about Trump on a day-to-day basis and reacting like very emotionally to everything he does is conducive to traffic. It's conducive to eyeballs. You know, it's like I started a thing called the Mindful Resistance Newsletter. It's kind of related to a book on Buddhism I wrote, but it actually largely means mindful just in the sense of like deliberate, considered, let's don't go crazy. Let's look at like what gave rise to Trumpism. What are the roots of it? What are the conditions in middle America and blah, blah, blah. And like, I just notice, and I've gotten some sympathy, like Vox did run a piece by me.
I saw your interview with Aaron Mate and I liked it. I think it's bad for your health to get worked up like that.
Right. But when I go around talking to people, like I said, Vox has shown some sympathy, but with that exception, when I talk to media outlets about that very approach, there's a resistance to it that I think has something to do with the fact that the more worked up they get, the better their traffic. So I think there's maybe a little bit. Let me, since we're running out of time, let me ask you if I can give you a quick kind of pop quiz that it's not a pop quiz, but that I didn't warn you about, so you don't have to take it. But I was just going to mention several websites that are prominent, Daily Beast, BuzzFeed, things like that. And if you pay more attention to this than I do, but if there's anything distinctive you can say about any kind of implicit or explicit foreign policy ideology, say it. And if not, fine. Or if it's all just part of the blob from your point of view, you can just say blob. That can be the default answer, meaning, you know, somewhere in the neocon to liberal interventionist zone. But whatever you want to say just briefly about, like, for example, the Daily Beast.
Neoconservative foreign policy coverage is heavily influenced by Michael Weiss, who has been a U.S. government contractor and a major promoter of the Russiagate narrative and regime change in Syria and permanent warfare in general.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and I should say, anyone who you name who begs to differ and wants to come on and talk to me about it, I'm all ears. They can have their day in court, but BuzzFeed.
BuzzFeed is like silly putty, reflective of the liberal sensibility, but no particular principles. And, you know, I've been smeared there for challenging the pro-Israel narrative by one of their major reporters. So I don't hold it in particularly high esteem.
Who's the reporter?
Rosie Gray, who's gone on to, you know, be part of the Beltway Press Corps. She at the time was dating the neoconservative Eli Lake, who's former co, you know, collaborator and friend at the New York Sun, which is run by the neoconservative Seth Lipsky, was Ben Smith, who is one of the major news editors at BuzzFeed. So this
Ben was at the Sun?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, him and Eli Lake were Seth Lipsky's golden boys. And this neoconservative network functioned in typically incestuous fashion to attempt to smear me and drive me to the margins when I began my book tour on Goliath. So that was my experience with BuzzFeed early on. They've expanded, obviously, and there is some good reporting there, but it's generally kind of a challenger to the New York Times.
In the sense of?
It's hard to say that it represents anything except kind of the sensibility of its readers, who are coastal liberals.
So you're not attributing as much ideological coherence to it on foreign policy as you are to the Daily Beast.
Absolutely not. And the Daily Beast is a smaller operation. I know that the editor-in-chief is John Avlon, who is a former speechwriter for Giuliani and kind of a moderate Republican, but you know, the fingerprints of Michael Weiss are all over its coverage, and it's been, you know, a major avenue for Russia hysteria and dubious Russiagate reporting.
What about The Atlantic?
The Atlantic is, the intellectually highbrow, liberal publication that does, fundraising events with the defense industry. I occasionally find some useful material in there, but it's generally an open door for liberal interventionists, neoconservatives. I find it amazing that the only person really permitted to write regularly about Russia is Julie Ioffe, and it's because she's, you know, one of the prominent Putin critics. Not someone.
She spent a lot of time on the Putin is crazy thesis for a while, right? Which seemed to me dangerously mistaken.
It's pretty clear he's a rational actor, but right. That she advanced the, this kind of highly offensive theme that Russia had somehow influenced Black Lives Matter, and that, you know, Black Lives Matter was a Russian tool for promoting division in this country. I mean, I think Black Lives Matter was promoting democracy in this country and protecting one of the most defenseless and oppressed populations in the history of humanity. Mm-hmm. But she took this cynical view, which was kind of being pushed by the House Intelligence Committee. And Ta-Nehisi Coates said nothing about that. He had nothing to say to challenge that. I mean, he's really said nothing about this whole episode.
Well, he's not a foreign policy guy.
This isn't about foreign policy. It's about
the Black Lives Matter thing. I see.
Reviving a McCarthyite narrative. And, you know, his whole debate with Cornel West was about, in many ways, he hadn't said much about the Palestinians. He hadn't said much about foreign policy. But it's just like your colleague at The Atlantic is smearing Black Lives Matter as a kind of a Russian tool to divide America. And you have nothing to say about that either. So in many ways, I think the Atlantic represents, kind of highbrow liberalism. And, you know, I don't want to attack all the writers there, but, you know, when I meet people who are regular readers of the Atlantic, they tend to kind of have been heavily invested in a lot of the resistance narratives, but with a lot more confidence than, you know, other people who read the lower brow magazines, because they believe that they're getting the mm-hmm. Objective facts from people who are thought leaders.
And what about the New Yorker?
I used to enjoy it much more. I mean, you're talking to someone who's become extremely disillusioned.
What's the sense I'm getting?
I mean, you know, on issues like Syria and Russia. On Syria, the New Yorker was basically hyping up all of the U.S. government and U.K.-funded regime change operations in rebel-held territory to push for an American intervention around Aleppo. I was kind of dismayed by that. I mean, there's a case of editorial dereliction when they're not identifying sources as U.S. government-funded operations. For example, you know, the white helmets and a lot of the media activists they were quoting in Aleppo. Beyond that, you know, I know David Remnick. I like him a lot. But he, you know, has definitely been someone who's heavily invested in the kind of anti-Russian narrative that I think, you know, fine, be anti-Russian, but at least bring people some context and at least have a debate. And there just hasn't been a debate. And then, you know, then you have the New Yorker Fiction, the New Yorker Book Reviews, the covers of the New Yorker, which, you know, are increasingly crude and just, you know, mocking Trump as a, you know, Russian tool. It's like, you know, it's just, it fits hand in glove, perfectly dovetails with the kind of Saturday Night Live liberalism where they might have been upset about losing the election. But now it's almost like they're gleeful about it. And, you know, losing Trump would be mean losing so much delightment and so much glee. You know, if you're left with Mike Pence, who can you mock? So all of these publications speak to the same sensibility, but it's unclear what kind of principles or agenda they're actually advancing.
Okay, so I guess we could go on, but we do have to draw us to a close. Are there any publications you particularly approve of? We mentioned that The Intercept. You said I hadn't heard this, but you say there's kind of a struggle for the soul of the nation going on. I would have thought that the nation is broadly speaking acceptable to you, but any other publications you want to mention?
Well, Blogging Heads is great. It's my favorite.
Blogging Heads has featured some of your least favorite people, but also some of your most favorite.
Look, I'm in favor of a debate, and that's okay. Just one thing we haven't had much of in the Trump era, particularly between liberal and left. But, you know, I look at publications based on issues. And so, you know, on Israel-Palestine, there are great publications. The Real News is a really exciting multimedia left-wing site that actually has debates. And I would encourage people to keep an eye on it because Ben Norton and I will be moving there.
Aaron Maté, is that how he pronounces his name?
Aaron Maté is doing a great job there. There are lots of really interesting podcasts right now that people don't know about. And, you know, I could rattle them off, but I mean, I don't want to.
Okay. Well, let me, I want to, one more plug for me, which is that if anybody wants to subscribe to the Mindful Resistance newsletter, they can go to mindfulresistance.net, but also back to your plugs, Moderate Rebels, just getting off the ground. I've listened to part one of the Vice one. It's very interesting. I eagerly await part two, which will show up maybe, I don't know, maybe by the time this goes up, who knows. But anything else you want to plug that you're doing?
Dan Cohen, an independent journalist, and I have a documentary that we've just completed called Killing Gaza, which is an on-the-ground portrait of life under siege. We started filming it in 2014 during the war in Gaza, and we continued filming all the way through 2015 to just show what it's like to be under siege. We're shopping it to festivals right now, but look out for trailers and, you know, we're going to do some exclusive preview filmings as well. And I should have a book out later this year on how 9/11 and the war on terror helped bring us Donald Trump and far-right nationalism in Europe and ISIS in the Middle East. That'll be out on Verso. And in the meantime, I will just try to be a gadfly over on the margins of the left at the Real News. And, you know, would hope to come back on here at some point, hopefully in a more hopeful time.
Well, I don't think we should wait that long.
I'll try to be mindful in the meantime.
Okay. Okay. We will have you back then. And if times are more hopeful, that's great, but that may be a while. Thanks a lot, Max.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Okay.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.